Welcome back to Page of the Wind, the podcast where we read Patrick Rothfuss's The Name of the Wind, page by page. This is page 284, and in the 10th anniversary edition, it is page 272. Adding a second sympathetic link between the candle and a more substantial fire. I broke my mind into two pieces, one binding Heme and the doll together, the other connecting the candle and the brazier. We get the desired effect. I casually moved the foot of the wax doll into the space about an inch above the candle's wick, which is actually the hottest part of the flame. There was a startled exclamation from where Heme was sitting. Without looking in his direction, I continued speaking to the class in the driest tones. "And it appears that this time we are successful," the class laughed. I blew out the candle. This is also a good example of the power that a clever sympathist commands. Imagine what would happen if I were to throw this doll into the fire itself. I held it over the brazier. As if on cue, Heme stormed onto the stage. It may have been my imagination, but it seemed to me that he was favoring his left leg slightly. "It appears that Master Heme wishes to resume your instruction at this point." Laughter rippled through the room. Louder this time. "I thank you all, students and friends, and thus my humble lecture ends. At this point, I used one of the tricks of the stage. There's a certain inflection of voice and body language that signals a crowd to applaud. I cannot explain how exactly it is done, but it had its intended effect." I nodded my head to them and turned to face Heme amidst applause, which, though far from deafening, was probably more than any he had ever received. As he took the last few steps toward me, I almost backed away. His face was fearsome, red, and a vein pulsed in his temple as if it were about to explode. For my own part, my stage training helped me maintain my composure. I returned his gaze levelly and held out my hand for him to shake. It was with no small amount of satisfaction that I watched him give a quick glance to the still applauding class, swallow, and shake my hand. His handshake was painfully tight. It might have gotten worse if I hadn't made a slight gesture over the brazier with the wax doll. His face went from a livid red to an ashen white more quickly than I would have believed possible. And that's the page.
I'm Nick.
I'm Jordana.
I'm Jeremy.
And this page has another one of those things that make me roll my eyes about acting techniques. For one thing, okay, so on this page, Kvothe says, "There's a subtle thing that actors can do to signal an audience to applaud. I can't explain it." Well, there is a thing that you can do to signal the audience to applaud, and it is very easy, and it is what Kvothe did, and it's right there on the page. It's you tell them you're done. So Kvothe does this a couple of ways. He does a Shakespearean thing where he ends in a rhyming couplet. All of Shakespeare's scenes end in a rhyming couplet. Or maybe not all, but many, many, many of them end in a rhyming couplet. He says, let me see here. Where is it? "I thank you all, students and friends, and thus my humble lecture ends."
I never noticed that. It's even in iambs.
Yeah. Yep. It's an...
"I thank you all, students and friends, and now my humble lecture ends." That's amazing!
Yes. So that, if anything, is a better signal to applaud because we, at least anyone who has grown up in a world where Shakespeare is the foundation of our literature and theater, probably is in some way conditioned to recognize that as the end of something. Also, you know, you can kind of bow, and there is body language to signal that you're done, and this is not on the page, but in theater, when the lights go down, people will applaud, and you sometimes will see in less professional shows, in between scenes, they'll bring the lights down, and then they'll bring it up, and like people will sort of go, "Oh," and then like they'll think it's over, and they'll start applauding, and then the lights will go up again, and then they go, "Oh, I wasn't supposed to applaud." Like, professional theater shows will never bring the lights all the way down. They'll dim them or change the lighting to indicate a scene change or to hide a scene change, but they won't bring them down until they want applause to happen.
That's an interesting little, like, semiotic trick that I never knew.
But anyway, the idea that
Kvothe is talking out of his ass here.
Yeah, and this is another example of Rothfuss being, like, I think he's kind of, what's the word? Not fetishizing, not...
Mysterious?
Yeah, he's
there's something we're forgetting, though.
He's making theater? Things up.
Yeah, okay. What are we forgetting, Jordana?
We're forgetting that this might not be the way that Rothfuss would put it. It is might maybe the way that Coate is telling the story.
Okay, fine. Rothfuss has sure protected himself against criticism.
I think that the simplest explanation here is that Rothfuss is making it up. And that's what writers do, and it's fine.
Yeah.
If you had never told me any of this, it would have rung completely true to me.
I suppose. It makes Quoth's acting a little more magical, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Much in the same way that sympathy is sort of there's a fake science behind the sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that there's kind of a fake science behind the acting that is also a little bit magical is maybe mm-hmm. the point of it.
And as someone who is not a trained actor, I have always found acting to be magical, and therefore it rings true to me. Jordana, I feel like you must have notes.
I do. Not that many for this page, though, but one of them is the question of which maybe did Quoth take it too far? Which I think is going to garner different responses from both of you, but I just wanted to ask.
Before we get into that, I just want to reply to Jeremy's acting is magical thing.
Mm-hmm.
As a trained actor, I can say with certainty that acting is deeply mundane, and if there's any aspiring actors out there, I can also say with certainty that the less hard you work, the better at it you will be.
Interesting. So sort of like a what comes naturally kind of thing?
Just that, like, if you overthink it, it will show. Mm-hmm. So if you, like, act really hard, you're not acting well. And this is maybe why the idea of, like, the airhead actor permeates, because a lot of people who aren't very self-aware or self-critical do make very good actors, because they just sort of do it without thinking.
Mm.
Anyway, we're getting into some dark places, so let's
interesting.
Navigate away from there.
I think structurally, this is a great... If the last two pages were the first and second acts of Quoth's little lecture, this is a great third act, because we've seen the build-up. And I was wrong when we were talking about the last page. I was wrong about how he makes his piece of sympathy work, because he has a second... What I seem to recall we sort of learned in his lessons with Ben is that you can't do that much interesting with, like, one sympathetic link. But if you have sort of a chain of sympathetic links... He makes this work by having a sympathetic link from the big fire to the candle, and a sympathetic link from the wax doll to Hemi.
And it's a double binding, which is what makes it so important later on.
Well,
like, it's a plot point that it's a double binding.
But isn't a double binding when you bind one thing to two other things?
I don't know.
It is an impressive binding. Mm-hmm. I think that's the point.
Yeah,
they call it a double binding.
Yeah, so I guess it is a double binding.
Oh, they call it... Yeah, right, you're right. When he's on the horns. You're
and
right.
This is also important because he targeted... He does this double binding so he can target Hem's foot. Because if he just tosses it in the brazier, he risks, like, burning Hem all over.
Yeah, so he'll kill him.
I don't know about kill him, but, like, it'll burn him all over. But this is, a very careful target. And he'd also... It's going through two links so that it can't possibly hurt him. It just gives him, it warms his foot up, right? That's all it really does. He doesn't actually burn.
Well,
but he does.
No, I think Hem is putting on a show a little bit. We'll get to that.
I think the implication is that he could have killed him if he threw the thing in the fire, because he says, can you imagine what would happen if I were to throw this doll into the fire itself?
Maybe.
That's a pretty leading, I could kill him. And, like, that's why people are afraid of sympathists and think of them as, like, evil wizards.
And it's also probably why Heme's face goes from red to white.
It's 35% when he's got the wax hair and the candle before he's done the second binding to the big fire.
It's more percent after.
Okay. I'm not going to think too hard about it. Okay.
That's right.
Probably all for the best.
So you asked if we think Quoth has gone too far.
Yes.
I don't think he has. But I think he realizes that he might have, because of the way Hemi reacts. Like, Hemi, if the students weren't there, Hemi would kill him. Hemi is like, murderously angry in this moment. And the only reason he doesn't, like, at the very least, like, punch Quoth is because he sees that there's a class of applauding students. Right?
Yeah.
Like, That's why he swallows his pride, and the best he can do is like trying to crush Quoth's hand in his. And he can't even do that because Quoth threatens to, I might kill you. I also think, I realize I've been rambling for a while. I have one more thing I want to say, which is that we have a really good sense of the mood of the audience in this scene and how Quoth gets them from being like quiet and shy and a little timid to like being engaged and then actively on his side and like, oh, wow. You know? And I think that's an important piece of set dressing, I guess.
Well, it's also the start of Quoth's legend.
Legend, yes.
Yeah, that he, you know, he works this crowd, he gets them on his side, he gets people talking.
Mm-hmm.
My take on this is that ethically, Quoth hasn't gone too far. I think he's stood up for himself, he's stood up for this bully, or against this bully. But I think he has committed the perfect Quoth, like a great example of the Quoth fallacy of acting without thinking or without assessing the consequences or really understanding what he was getting into, because now he has made an enemy for life. Like, he should have known that him, who being a vindictive, immature brat with power, would attempt to use it to, you know, like, would hold a deep grudge about this, you know, that he had more than enough information to figure that out. And now he has one of the masters, you know, he's like day three. Now one of the masters is out for his blood forever.
And he also, if he had maybe stopped to think about it, he would have been like, oh, it's probably against the law or something to try and use sympathy to like hurt somebody.
Yes, that too.
I would like to share my answer to my own question.
Please.
Of course.
Which is that I think he did go too far. And the reason being that because there was a high road here and he did not take it. The high road being that there were three pieces of metal. He could literally have shown the exact same first lesson. He could have still shown up Heme without hurting him. And he did not take that opportunity.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that's why we get the full inventory. So that we can look back and say, did he have to do that? No, actually he didn't. And also, Jordana, when has Quoth ever taken the high road?
And furthermore, sometimes taking the high road is not the right thing to do.
Right, but Quoth never. Quoth never lets a slight go unpunished. He never, like...
Hashtag never... Quoth did nothing wrong.
Okay. Are we done with our subject matter for the page?
I think so.
We have some letters.
Mailbag!
This is a letter from John.
But not the regular John. Is it?
I don't recall. What's
it's not the wizard.
No, it's not. It's not John with the name from
the thing
from the castle. This is a different John.
John writes, "Hey guys, I've been binging through the podcast, and I just got to episode 100. In regards to your disagreement about Quoth's chide to Bast that seemed too quiet to be heard, my read is that it seems too quiet to be heard because ostensibly Bast is much further away. Actually, he is closer than they thought, and that is why he can hear what otherwise would seem to have been too quiet." This is in reference to page 100.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just looking back here to see
what John's on about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is when Bast claims to have been away reading Thelem Tintir, and... But Quoth right away calls him out for eavesdropping. And I guess, so I don't actually recall that conversation, but I suppose we thought it odd that Bast was located. Maybe we figured that Bast was located farther away than he actually was. But looking back on it now, it seems clear that he probably was just like behind the door, his ear pressed to the door or something. I think John is right. I think if we made a big stink out of this, we probably just like...
We probably just tell him making a big stink?
Yeah, well, Tekum's razor... he probably was just hiding behind the door, not actually upstairs. Oh, there we go. Oh, no, here it is. No, here it is. I'm wrong. It's, Quoth calls out, "Bast, bring up some cider, would you?" An indistinct reply echoed from a doorway at the back of the room. "Bast," Quoth chided, seemingly too quiet to be heard. So, I think Bast is maybe throwing his voice, to, like, echoing from the doorway at the back of the room. No, he's, like, right behind that doorway. He's not echoing. He's, like, right there, like, oh, shit, so he can hear him because Quoth knows, okay, if I talk this loud, he will be able to hear me because he's actually that close. That's what we were talking about.
I missed that.
Thank you for your letter. Welcome to the party, pal.
Nailed it. I think we got time for one more.
Yay!
So this is a letter from Patrick, not Rothfuss.
Hi.
And it's a doozy.
Oh, boy.
Page 245. Patrick writes, "Hi, all. First, I want to respond to Joy's letter that you read today. And then I have some notes on the page. This is in reference to the long letter that Joy wrote us about realizing that Quoth is a victim of sexual assault. Joy is definitely not alone in missing the heavy implication that Quoth is a sexual assault victim. I read both books several times before I picked up on that. Once I realized the true significance of that scene, it became so obvious that I wondered how I missed it in the first place. On the page, Quoth, as the narrator, says he knew he would never see Denna again after this parting. One of you held this up as an example of Quoth being an unreliable narrator, but I disagree. He is saying that he was certain at the time that he would never see Denna again. In general, I do not think that Quoth is an unreliable narrator. He may be biased in some areas, but I do not think he is intentionally lying to the audience. He says more than once that he is taking this chance to tell a true version of his story. He especially emphasizes this after Bast freaks out about the Cathaia. At the end of the page, Quoth says, "I'll see you where the roads meet," to Denna as they part. You all thought this was used somewhere else in the books, but could not remember where. I do not think this exact phrase is used again, but something very similar is used in the story Quoth tells Simon and Willem at the beginning of Wise Man's Fear. This excerpt is from the end of chapter 36. "There is a place not many folk have seen, a strange place called Fyrinial. If you believe the stories, there are two things that make Fyrinial unique. First, it is where all the roads in the world meet. Second, it is not a place any man has found by searching. It is not a place you travel to. It is the place you pass through while on your way to somewhere else. They say that anyone who travels long enough will come there. This is the story of that place, and of an old man on a long road, and of a long and lonely night without a moon." After Quoth tells the story, he explains that this is a story from the Edimaru. I pronounce Ru like Hugh. Edimaru. Edimaru. This is a story that the Edimaru tell each other, and is not usually told to an outside audience. From this, I think that the expression is something that the Ru would use when parting with friends, and is not a common expression outside of the Ru. The name and the story taking place on a moonless night suggest that Fyrinial is in the Feyen realm. Also, Fyrinial fits into the something-something-L at the end of Arladin's poem about the Greystone. I would go on here, but this letter is already too long. I would love to hear what you guys think of this. Thanks for keeping the podcast going. Signed, Patrick, not Rothfuss.
Tantalizing.
There's so many things.
I have one thing that I want to say. I feel like you guys are going to have more things. I take issue with your definition of an unreliable narrator, because anytime a narrator has their own bias and lets that inject what they tell or choose to omit from a story, that makes them unreliable.
I agree with Jeremy. I still think Quoth is an unreliable narrator, because despite the fact that he might not be doing it on purpose, he's still doing it.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a misconception among some people that unreliable narrator means intentionally unreliable, and it does not. It just means a narrator who lacks all the information.
Mm-hmm. Or lets their biases color the story.
Mm.
As to the Fyrinial being the place where roads meet, like,
oh yeah,
oh, so many things going through my head right now. Definitely not enough time to cover them. The idea that, like, he uses that saying, does he ever meet Denna in that place? Will that ever happen? I don't know. I'll let you have a turn before I just
this is
words.
As good as confirmation for me that Greystone leads to, you know,
Fyrinial.
To gay Fyrinial. Fyrinial. Yeah. I think it's Fyrinial. I think, because roads.
What if they are the waystones. Same place?
Oh, maybe. Oh. Oh. Oh.
What was the other option? Yeah. It was Fyrinial or Mir Tirinial. Right. So
what if the cities aren't cities but worlds? What if the cities are metaphor for worlds and there were seven worlds? And the only ones that survived were the real world and Mir Tirinial.
Ooh.
And, like, Fyrinial, right? Because a lot of the things we see in these stories are metaphors, right? Or what was the phrase you used? Of
metonymy?
A metonymy, something small standing in for a bigger thing.
Oh, very good.
And maybe, hasn't Rothfuss gone on record saying that there are X number of magics? Maybe each magic is left over from one world? This is a big leap. But I'm just, maybe there's something to this, guys. Maybe they're not cities, but they're worlds. Dang.
At the very least, I think that your cultural history of that phrase as being tied into that story that the Edimaru tell each other is entirely plausible, and I buy it 100%.
That was an exciting letter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Patrick. As always, a pleasure.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, We've now gone on quite a while.
We are a proud member of the Dork Shelf Podcast Network.
I'm Nick.
I'm Jordana.
I'm Jeremy. And this has been
Page
of the Whale.